Hello, my name is Tim Schwartz, and welcome to the Life After Blindness podcast. This week, my guest is Holly Bonner from blindmotherhood.com. I will also be sharing with you some recent news from the blindness community involving AMC theaters and audio description, astronomy accessibility coming out of University of Chicago, as well as some artificial intelligence news coming out of Google as it relates to those with diabetic retinopathy. And later in the podcast, I'll be talking with you about the 2-year anniversary of the Apple Watch. This is episode number 8, and your Life After Blindness journey continues right now. Hello, I am your host, Tim Schwartz, and I'd like to welcome you to Life After Blindness. This is the podcast where we are dedicated to the exploration of an enabled life with blindness. I hope everyone out there is doing well. I know that I am. My Cincinnati Reds are in first place, and I'll be going on vacation in just a few weeks with my family. And in today's episode, I have a lot of great things to share with you. Before we get into all that, I just want to let you know that you can get links to everything I talk about here in this episode by going to lifeafterblindness.com/8. While you're there, if you'd like, you can send me an email or follow me on Facebook or Twitter. Now, like I said, we have a lot to get to this week. Later in the podcast, I'll be talking with you about the Apple Watch. Its 2-year anniversary just happened near the end of April, and so I thought I would take some time to talk with you about the differences between Series 1 and Series 2 of the second generation Apple Watches, and tell you a little bit about what made my decision when it came time for me to buy the Apple Watch. Also in this episode, I speak with Holly Bonner. Holly comes to us from blindmotherhood.com. As you heard in episode number 6 last month, when Derek Daniel from lifeaftersightloss.com talked to us about the stay-at-home father's point of view when it comes to parenting and taking care of your family and household, I'm going to talk with Holly today about the mother's point of view, so be sure to stick around for that. But first, I have several news items that I thought were important to discuss with you this week. So before we get into anything else, let's start with the news. Our first story this week comes out of San Francisco, where it was recently announced that a legal settlement will cause AMC movie theaters to undergo sweeping reforms that will greatly help blind and visually impaired moviegoers. Oftentimes, a blind or visually impaired person could show up at the theater and be given the wrong device. So rather than receiving the audio description device for the blind, you may receive a captioning device for the deaf. Or you might get into the theater with the correct device, but find that it doesn't work or the battery is dead. And so what this 2-year settlement will do is actually multiple things. First of all, it will allow for training for the AMC employees so that they are familiar with the different types of devices and what they do. They'll be trained on how they work. So if you have any questions yourself about how to utilize one of these devices, they can walk you through that. Also, the devices will be checked and maintained on a weekly basis, so you can expect them to be clean as well as batteries to be properly refreshed. And AMC will keep track of any complaints concerning the audio description devices so that a disability advocate can then review those complaints at a later time. AMC has also agreed to add audio description to any of their pre-movie theater announcements. So any of those announcements that encourage you to go to the lobby and get food and popcorn and get extra soft drinks, those hopefully will have description as well as any other kind of pre-movie announcements that they offer. It also requests that AMC work with the movie companies when getting trailers for upcoming films to provide audio description for those trailers. By doing this with adding audio description for the pre-movie announcements as well as trailers, you'll have an opportunity to test your audio description device before the movie even starts, so you know that when the movie begins, you have a working device. Now, in addition to these in-theater changes, AMC has also agreed to make sure that their website as well as apps are accessible with screen reader technology on smartphones, and they also will provide information as to what films and times will have audio description. The long-term goal of a settlement like this is that it will trickle down to other movie theaters, and this could become a standard for how audio description, as well as even captioning devices, are utilized and maintained with different movie companies. And this should provide a much better experience for blind and visually impaired moviegoers. Already, we know that the FCC requires movie theaters that provide digital movie screenings to have audio description. And so I think this is a really good extension of that via a legal avenue, of course, as opposed to FCC regulations. But I think that this is a great step forward in being able to show that there are many more aspects to providing a service for somebody that is blind or visually impaired, rather than just saying, well, we have audio description. They also are saying, well, but we're going to make sure that this is the best experience possible for that moviegoer. And so I really think that this was one of those lawsuits that was a good thing and will hopefully have a great outcome going forward. Over the next 3 years, with the help of a $2.5 million National Science Foundation grant, the Yerkes Observatory at the University of Chicago is hoping to give better access to astronomy to blind and visually impaired students. With the help from blind and sighted students alike from surrounding schools in Illinois and Wisconsin, the Yerkes Observatory is hoping to develop software called Afterglow Access that will help them be able to understand better how to bring accessibility to the blind and visually impaired. Their theory is that when astronomers use 2D imaging or data to track the stars, wouldn't it be a lot better if they could be able to translate that information into 3D printed technology, tactile technology, or even sound? They might be able to better bring astronomy and the exploration of space to blind and visually impaired students. Even though this study has just gotten underway, I'm really excited about something like this. I wasn't blind when I was a kid, but I was always very interested in astronomy and the planets and the stars. And so had I been blind as a child, something like this would have been really interesting for me and would have provided for me a lot of excitement as far as being able to get better 3D renderings of space and getting that sound or that tactile display as to what space is and what it's all about. So any kind of study like this, I think, is just fantastic and is a great step forward in being able to help students better understand the world around them, or in this case, the space above. The final story that I want to talk about with you this week comes to us from Google. Google engineers have found that the same AI that they use in their Google imaging technology to identify faces of humans, faces of animals, can also be used to read a person's retinas to find out in early stages if a person has diabetic retinopathy. Google says that they aren't looking to replace doctors with this artificial intelligence technology, but they're hoping to aid doctors in early detection and prevention so that diabetics who may ultimately get diabetic retinopathy can get it detected as early as possible. Technology like this is really amazing, and I think this is just the very beginning of something bigger where we will find that artificial intelligence, imaging technology, and other types of technology will be able to help when it comes to the eye or many other parts of the body. And so I think stories like this are important to keep an eye on, pardon the bad pun, so that we can see what might happen in the future, to see how much better and broader this technology can become to help not just those with diabetic retinopathy, but many other types of visual impairments as well going forward. Today we're talking about blindness and how it relates to your household, from organization of the house to baby care, cleaning, cooking, and so many other things. And joining me to talk about some of these topics is a wife, mom, social worker, and coming to us from blindmotherhood.com, Holly Bonner. Welcome to the podcast, Holly.
Hi, Tim. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. Now, let's go first right into it and talk about organizing the house. I know with your YouTube channel and your blog, you do talk a little bit about organization and many other things, of course, that we'll get into. But talk to me about organizing your household and how that's helped you with your blindness?
Well, I think organization plays a huge role in anybody that's visually impaired and planning on either having a child or is currently pregnant or is living with a child right now. And to be fair, in my previously sighted life, I've only been blind 5 years. I was always a very organized person. I'm very type A personality. I like to have things where they belong. So that actually aided me when I lost my sight. But as soon as my husband and I found out that we were pregnant, we really started to think about different things that we could improve in our house to keep us organized. The first thing that we really looked at was the overall layout of our home. We have a very small home in New York, and we had a dining room that we did not use at all. We never had any family gatherings for the holidays. So we looked at getting rid of that furniture, and I ended up getting rid of that piece and a couple of other pieces of furniture that I could make room for some of the baby items that were necessary, like a pack and play and a swing, a mamaroo. These were things that I used when I had my first daughter, and that kind of started the organizational process. And we really, you know, got heavily into doing that probably around the time I was about 7 months pregnant, because around that time is when you start not really feeling good as a pregnant person. You don't really feel like doing much. And I was in nesting mode, you know, and then we tried to get as many things that we knew we needed for the baby. Like I mentioned, the pack and play and, you know, the swing, and put them in places where we knew that they were not going to be moved. So that gave me the opportunity as a blind mom to learn how to navigate around my house and make sure that I knew where they were and could, you know, start playing with the dials and, you know, kind of getting myself acclimated. So I would say that was a very big part of organization. The smaller things like the baby's clothes and, you know, the diapers, some of the lotions and things that you'll need, you know, I really recommend using a lot of organizational baskets. I like compartmental baskets. But for both my children, I had this one large basket where the center is all my diapers. And then to the left, I know I have the lotion. And to the right, I have, you know, the stuff for diaper rash. They call it butt paste. And I also have little baggies to put their dirty diapers. So all I have to do is tie them in a knot and throw them away. My husband is fully sighted. So to organize the clothing and some of the bath items so that he also knew where they were, is that we got Sterilite or Rubbermaid containers that were like tiers. So they were maybe like four drawers, you know, in each unit. And in one drawer, I would put, you know, all the onesies for the baby. And in the second drawer was all their bath, little bath towels with the hoods on them. So this was all stuff that was organized. And then my husband would actually write the word for whatever, you know, was in that bucket on there, so he could see visually what was in there and was able to put stuff back as he took out. Or, you know, when we had the laundry, he could put things away. So it really was about finding a balance between the two of us. And it's worked, you know, it's worked out really well. I will also say, if you live in a two-story home and you're visually impaired and just having an infant, you know, I always tell people, you're going to be so sleep deprived, especially with a newborn. So I tried to keep, you know, all my stuff organized on the first floor and the second floor. So that basket that I was describing a few minutes ago with the diapers, I had one upstairs as well, in the same exact layout, diapers in the middle, lotion to the left, butt paste to the right, little baggies. It was the same wherever you went in the house. And it was a really handy way for me to know where everything is, keep everything stocked. Because let me tell you something, when that baby has an explosion diaper, you don't want to be looking for that diaper. You do not want to be having to search for anything. So yes, I mean, you know, those were really some of the key organizational, things that we did. Once the kids start getting a little bit bigger and their toys start getting bigger and they become more mobile, I think, you know, around the time where they're starting to, you know, crawl or toddle around like 7-8 months, I would say to reevaluate your organization again. What are you still using? What can you get rid of? What can you put in storage? You know, what baby products are you moving? What are you replacing those with? And then again, when they're older and their toys get to be smaller, like my children now are 4 and 2, you know, I use a lot of cubby systems for them, and there's a place for everything and everything in its place. My children know where things go, and I expect them to be put back. And for the most part, they're pretty good. But I also emphasize that mommy is not like other mommies, you know, and I have a visual impairment, and they understand that even at 4 and 2. So they know that they have to make sure their toys are put away so mommy doesn't get hurt. You know, and that's something that my husband and I both try to reinforce with them, you know, so that we all stay organized.
I think that's absolutely helpful to say, you know, being organized, having that consistency, and then, as you said, reorganize as needed. And as a father of a 4-year-old myself, soon to be 5, you're right. They do understand at that age that, you know, mommy or daddy has this visual impairment, that I do need to put things in a certain place. And if you reinforce that properly and enough, they can understand. Obviously, they're still going to have their toys out here and there, but you're right. That is something that the children can also be helpful in. And as you said, it helps the whole family. It helps your husband, helped yourself. And I think it's good advice, you know, all around to be able to do that and maintain that organization. Now, diving into that a little bit deeper, let's go a little bit more into parenting as far as baby care itself. So we've talked about the organizational side and preparing for having a child and raising a child. Talk to me about some of the accommodations it might make for yourself when it comes to being a blind mom.
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people said to me, oh, you know, infancy is going to be the hardest for you, you know, especially with baby care. And looking back on both my daughters, I have got to say that was probably, you know, the least stressful time. It's when those babies get mobile that really challenged me as a blind mom. Right. You know, listen, you bring them home from the hospital and they're absolutely adorable. And all you want to do is snuggle them on your chest and smell them and, you know, just hold their little finger or touch their little feet, yep. You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, like, you know, one day it's like, boom, they're off. And then it's like, you know, you got to watch and see where they're going and, or try to listen for where they're going, you know? So it's more challenging pretty much when you bring them home from the hospital. If you lay them down someplace, they're going to stay there. Right. So, I mean, there were things that kind of tied into the organization that really did help me with the baby care. You know, I didn't breastfeed either of my children because I did have breast cancer, and my doctors, said that there wasn't enough information for them to say safely that, you know, you could breastfeed your child. So I did bottle feeding. Both my girls are huge. They're very, very well, you know, well fed, tall, smart, met all their milestone markers. But what I did in my kitchen was I actually used lasagna pans. So Rachel Ray makes these bubble and brown lasagna pan sets. And I got 2 of them, put them side by side on a counter that was dedicated to making the bottles. I called it my bottle station counter. I also had a plastic tray and a Brita water filter that I kept filled with water. And I had measuring cups. And basically what I did was I lined each of these lasagna pans with paper towels, lined up all my bottles. I tried many different bottle brands. The one that I liked the best was called Tommy Tippy.
Yes.
And they fit perfectly in there. And I would pre-fill them with the formula. Then all I had to do was measure out with my measuring cup and the Brita, you know, and I could make a bottle. And I had one in my kitchen and of these bottle stations, and I had one next to my nightstand for the night feedings, which was great. You know, it's something that people, when they came to my house and they were sighted and they saw this, they found it quite odd. They, you know, oh, I mean, because you know, sighted parents, you can go over, you want to make a bottle, it's no problem. But
sure.
Listen, I can get the job done. I just do it slightly different. You know, and it was hard for some people to adjust to that. I will say one of the biggest hurdles that I had with my children was finding diaper rash and baby care. And that was very, very difficult for me. You know, my husband and I, with our first daughter, she actually got a very, very bad case. And I get emails on Blind Motherhood all the time from moms who are petrified when this happens to their kids, because, you know, you have to take them to the pediatrician and you don't want the pediatrician thinking that you're doing a bad job. But basically, you know, my husband and I were new parents and we were changing the baby, you know, appropriately. So we thought she just had very, very sensitive skin, and she ended up getting a very, very bad case of diaper rash that required prescription medication, like a cream that we had to apply to her. So what I will say with that is always err on the side of caution. You know, whatever brand of diaper you choose, make sure you're changing the baby frequently, you know, especially after feedings, before feedings, get into a habit of doing it. You probably should change your baby anywhere between 8 to 10 times a day. You know, you're figuring you should do it about every hour. So that's something that I had to get myself into. As far as feeling for the diaper rash, you know, as you change your child, you know, you can actually feel the little bumps on some of the rashes. Sometimes you can even feel like an open sore or broken skin. So sometimes you have to really rely on that tactile sense that you have as a mom, and also your sense of smell. If you smell something, and I'm not talking, you know, about a number two diaper, I'm talking about something that smells odd to you, you know, never chance it, you know, get medical care, take them into the pediatrician. Thankfully, my pediatrician was great. And she was very, very helpful to both myself and my husband learning how to look for diaper rash and care for diaper rash. I always did a lot of prevention after that. Like I said, changing the diapers more frequently. I also started using butt paste with every diaper change, which is like a cream that kind of protects or acts as a buffer between the diaper and the baby. If your baby does get diaper rash, the best thing that you can do if it's severe is always take them to the doctor, but also leave the diaper off if you can. Let them air dry. Try not to use any wipes. Try to use like unscented toilet paper that's a little bit wet to clean them if they do a poop. That's good, you know, because you're not using any type of moisture from the wipes. You're not adding moisture into an area that's already being affected by moisture on your baby. You know, so a lot of things are live and learn with baby care. You know, that was a mistake I did not repeat with my second child because I was more aware. You know, you also, as a mom, you got to cut yourself a break, right? You're going to make mistakes. You're a dad. You're not perfect, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's something that you, if you're open to learning and you have a supportive pediatrician and a supportive partner or someone in your family who will help you if you need, then you will be able to manage, you know, baby care and doing everything a sighted parent can do. But you just have to find a way that kind of works for you and your visual impairment to accomplish it.
I completely agree with you that when it comes to baby care, especially, there are some things you have to do differently, as you talked about with the tactile feeling for different things, listening, smelling. But ultimately, the process isn't all that different, or really isn't that different from what a sighted person would do. It's just some minor changes, some minor adjustments that you have to make, making sure that you're organized, as you said, and feeling for and smelling for and listening for all those little baby clues that you might even find perhaps before your sighted partner might. I know a couple times that I came across the rash and I took the baby, you know, took our daughter directly to my wife and said, "Sweetheart, what is this? It feels like something's here. It's different." Because you, as you said, you get to know your baby, you know your child as you're changing them and clothing them and caring for them. And you know what it should be and what it should feel like and smell like. And so if there's something different, you may notice it before your spouse does.
Absolutely.
So I think that it's just being aware and using your skills and using the abilities that you have. And but again, I think that important point is to be made there that it's not that much different than how a sighted person would do it.
You're absolutely right. You know, and you think about, you know, when your wife was pregnant, or, you know, myself, you know, when I was pregnant, you know, when you're preparing for that baby and you go and everybody does a baby registry, right? You know, you're preparing for that baby. It's a big celebration. You got to go and try to touch some of these products, and you head over to your local, you know, Babies R Us or whatever big box baby store is near you. And you start touching things and feeling things. And, you know, what car seat can I clasp myself? What carriage can I open myself? You know, sometimes you just have to go and play, you know, and that was a really, really big thing for me when I was pregnant. And I tell parents that are visually impaired and women that are pregnant and visually impaired, go to your store that you are comfortable with, go at an off hour where there's nobody that's going to be there. You don't want to head to Babies R Us on a Saturday.
No.
Ain't nobody got time for that. Nobody wants to go there
no.
and deal with the crowds, you know? But go during the middle of the week, find some time, right? If you can go with, you know, your partner, your spouse, you know, and just start walking around and feeling things. There were some things that, you know, that people bought me, and I knew immediately that there was no way that I was going to use them. And, you know, I didn't find the use for some things. And then there were things that I did get that I was like, wow, I could adapt this for other things. You know, so you gotta find your own way, you know, and don't listen. Everybody's got an opinion. Take what part of that opinion is going to help you, and just whatever else they say, just throw it out the window, because you're going to get it out of everybody. Everybody's going to have something to say. And that was one of the most stressful things for me as a new mom. I felt very overwhelmed by the advice. And as soon as I started, you know, kind of filtering it a little bit, it was much easier for me to care for my children and enjoy being a mom, because you should enjoy it.
And ultimately, I think that's what it comes down to, is that there's a lot of good advice. And as you said, there's a lot of not so good advice out there as well. But you have to ultimately, as any parent, but especially as a blind parent, take the advice that's going to make you feel the most comfortable, that's going to prepare you the best, and what you think is going to work for you the best. Because ultimately, again, you're not going to necessarily do everything the way that a sighted parent would. So you can't approach every bit of it the same way that a sighted parent would. You have to think, well, is this something that I can feel? Can I use this? Like you said, with the car seat and high chairs and things like that, is this something that I can take the tray off the high chair properly? Can I put this together? Can I, you know, can I utilize, you know, this or that or the other? And so you have to think those things through, because having a baby can be quite costly, and there's a lot of things involved as far as, you know, buying the right things, preparing for the right things. And you don't want to have all these things that you've bought or other people have purchased that end up not being something you can work with, like you said, because tactily or for whatever other reason, you as a blind person can't use it. So I think that's very important, a point to make. Now, going from that preparedness and making sure that you're doing things with your babies that you can do, talk to me a little bit about some of the crafty things you've done as your children have gotten older. I know that you do a lot of arts and crafts with your children. Again, I know you said they're 4 and 2. And so you do a lot of things that you can participate in with them when it comes to crafts.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, you have to stimulate your children. You really do. And, you know, just like adults, I mean, it's the 5 senses for all of us, right? So their mom just happens to have 4 senses. You know, it's something that I did growing up. We always did a lot of crafts. And I don't know, I'm just very crafty. I like to embrace my inner Martha Stewart. Let's put it that way. So, you know, with them, you know, little kids, like, they don't care, you know, how it comes out. But, you know, as long as you praise them and tell them that they're doing a great job, then they absolutely love it. And display whatever they make, you know, in your kitchen or in your home, wherever is a good place. My go-tos with my kids are foam stickers. They almost have like a three-dimensional feel for them. You know, they usually make them for every single holiday. I love using those. I also love puffy paint, which after it dries, it has like a raised feel to it as well. I let my kids, you know, do that on leftover t-shirts or old t-shirts or even, you know, just regular construction paper. We use a lot of different paints in our house, you know, as well. Just I try to use like non-toxic water, able to be washed off or whatever paint. Crayola is a really great company that I go to. And then I always try to incorporate a season, you know, so now Easter's coming, right? So with my kids this week, we actually did paper plate bunnies, and I'll be doing a blog post on it in the next few days. But just took a regular old paper plate out of the kitchen cabinet, and then I took another one and cut it in half, and we, you know, taped ears on the bunny, and the kids drew a face on it. Done deal, right? They had a great time. It was, you know, a good, maybe, I don't know, 45-minute activity, and they loved it, you know. And it's something, too, that we talk about the season and get them excited about going to see the Easter Bunny, you know, different things like that. So every holiday I do something. I will say, out of all the holidays, my most favorite, with the name being Holly, as you could guess, is Christmas.
Sure.
So as soon as October 1st hits, I am ready for Hallmark Christmas movies and decorating.
Oh, you're one of those.
I'm one of those, yes. Absolutely. And then the day after Christmas, actually probably like Christmas afternoon, I'm like, I'm over it. Let's take all this stuff down. I'm ready for Valentine's Day. And that's how it goes. But you know, people say to me a lot on Blind Motherhood and on my Facebook page, I go all out for the holidays. And we made a leprechaun trap, things like that. My kids love it. And, you know, it breaks it up. I mean, like, you know, sometimes the monotony of parenthood is exhausting. It feels like Groundhog Day sometimes every friggin' day, you know? So doing stuff like that is a great way to connect with my kids and have an activity that they'll learn something and also to challenge them artistically. You know, I want them to do things like that as they get older. I want them to be creative. And that's one way that I'm promoting creativity with both of them.
I really like that, the idea that you can incorporate not only some themed artistic events, you know, with them, with the holidays, maybe even other themes that you could incorporate in. So that helps them learn about the different holidays. You can even, you know, incorporate other things to be educational, of course, in the arts and crafts that you do. And so you're educating them, you're spending time with them. And because you're using things like cardboard cutouts, paper plates, you know, the puffy paint, all those kind of things, it's tactile for you. So it's something that you can feel. I mean, obviously when they just draw on a flat, you know, 2D surface, you're not feeling that, but
that's right.
You're incorporating other things along with that, that mom can also enjoy and feel what they've done. And then I know from my own experience with my 4-year-old, anything that she creates that she can hand to me and I feel it and I can interact with it. Not only does that bring me pleasure as her father to be able to say, oh, wow, I do feel what you've done here and I got an idea of what it is and wow, that's great. Good job. That just brightens her up to know that dad was able, you know, daddy was able to feel that and know what she created and that she made something that dad could feel and, you know, enjoy as well. So I know that it brings her joy to do that. So I think that that's just a wonderful thing to be able to do, to not only be able to involve yourself as a blind mom, but to involve them and educate them and really do something that brings you together.
Absolutely. And you know, you're really boosting your child's self-esteem. You know, you're helping them understand about your visual impairment. And it really is something that, as you said, it brightens their day, you know, quite a bit. You know, and you can also incorporate, you know, as they get older now, I'm doing more stuff with beads. Things that I will be able to hear as they move, you know, making dream catchers, things like that, that, you know, maybe some of the movement I can catch, or maybe I could hear, you know, the different jingling of bells or of beads together. So the older they get, the more you can do, which is great. But you have to be cautious when they're really little, because, you know, you don't want anything getting in their mouths, in their eyes. So always err on the side of caution and have fun.
Absolutely. I want to talk with you about cooking. I know that another thing that you do a lot of is talk about cooking and recipes and things like that. So talk to me about being blind and getting around your kitchen.
I have to say, I was never a chef. I, you know, after I had my daughter, thankfully, you know, I was very, very newly blind. I got pregnant 6 months after I lost my eyesight, and I was only, you know, less than a year blind when I gave birth to her. So, you know, we did the bottle thing, and then we went to the oatmeal, and that was easy enough. And then, you know, we did the baby food, and then it was like, okay, she's got to eat regular food. What do I do?
Right.
I didn't know. I mean, my husband and I, you know, we were regulars at our local Applebee's and our IHOP and Perkins, and everybody knew us at the diner on a first name basis.
Sounds familiar.
Yes. And I was like, now I have to feed this child that I created. So I had a really, really great adult daily living skills instructor. Her name is Monica Torres in New York City out of the Jewish Guild for the Blind, which is now GuildNet. And she really worked with me. And I really had to start at the bottom. And that was with my chopping skills and, you know, just working on those knife skills, learning how to cut up different, you know, fruits and veggies into pieces that I knew that she was not going to choke and that I could give to her. One of the biggest fears I had as a mom was that I was going to undercook something, that something would make her sick or make my husband sick, and it would be my fault. I was terrified of it, absolutely terrified. So what I started out with was using the crock pot. And I have to tell you, there is very, very little you could put in a crock pot that if you leave it on for 8 hours is not going to cook. So, you know, I did whole chickens in the crock pot, you know, and then I would shred the meat and have her, you know, do that. I made mashed potatoes, which easy enough, right? Peel the potato, boil them, you know, a little bit of milk and butter, you're good to go, right? Mash them up. And I started small, and then I kind of branched out into some of the other recipes that I make now. You know, like I can cook a whole prime rib. I can do a Thanksgiving turkey. It sounds funny to people when I tell them that, because they're like, I don't know, they seem like terrified. Like they don't want to eat anything that I make, which is, I'll tell you, you know, I'm actually pretty good, you know, and I didn't know that I enjoyed it as much until I really had to do it as, you know, as a mom. I am a firm believer in giving your kids healthy food. I'm not like all organic or, you know, whatever, but I mean, I grew up with very, very, you know, limited nutrition. Like for us, when we were kids, breakfast was cookies and milk. That was breakfast. I mean, you know, you would think, yeah, I had the coolest mom ever, but nutritionally, that was not what I needed, you know? So, you know, for my girls, they have a banana in the morning or cut up strawberries and blueberries. They love yogurt. They love avocado. So I try to mix some of the fresh produce that's seasonal with whatever I'm making. They love pasta. Pasta is a really easy thing to make. You know, what's your favorite thing to eat, Tim? What do you like? What does your wife make?
Oh, gosh, she makes so many things that I like. There's a, what is it called? A sausage bake. I'm not even sure how to describe it, but I mean, it's cheese and all kinds of different things in the sausage bake. I mean, there's so many different things that she makes that I just love. Even something as simple as spaghetti and meatballs or burgers, because she makes her own meatballs. When she makes hamburgers, she puts all kinds of secret things in there that I'm not allowed to know about, but you know, she seasons them with things. So they're simple things that I love them, you know, and they're so good, and I know that they're hers. So,
right. You know, and that's a good point too. You know, your wife makes meatballs, right? So I'll just give you an example. I make meatballs maybe once a week, right? So for the kids, I can slice those meatballs up like one whole meatball, put it on a plate. They're eating that there and they're getting their protein, right? When it comes to feeding my husband, I can use those meatballs to make spaghetti and meatballs. I can slice those up for him and put them on a Hero and make him a meatball sub with just a little bit of mozzarella cheese. Or I could boil some ziti and I could put the meatballs cut up into a pan and cook it and make a baked ziti with the meatballs in it. My husband calls that pasta della Holly. He likes that. You know, there's so many ways to, you know, stretch a dollar, make a meal. You can do it. It's tasty. Your kids are going to get the nutrition. Your husband or your partner is going to be fed. And you could do it. I mean, it's all about experimenting and having a good teacher. Because I will say that Monica, if I did not have her, I don't think I would be where I am now as far as cooking.
And I think what's great about what you've explained is that not only have you found that you enjoy it, you like it, and the food ends up being liked by others, you know, your family likes it, and that's obviously the most important, but then you found that you can do it accessibly, that you don't have to have vision to dive into the kitchen and make these things. You can make anything from simple dishes up to, as you said, prime rib and your own meatballs, and
right,
with very few accessible tools, you're able to do that. So it definitely can be done, sighted or not. And you enjoy it. And I think that's absolutely important.
I really do. I'll tell you, the biggest challenge that I have with cooking is not even the cooking. It's the ordering of the groceries. I use a ShopRite from home, which, you know, I get my groceries delivered. And I use Zoom Text on my computer to allow me to order online and then it's delivered to the house. But every now and then, you know, I'll just be off with, you know, the ordering or the cursor when I'm using my computer, and I'll want to purchase, say, 5 potatoes to make mashed potatoes. And I cannot tell you how many times 5 5-pound bags of potatoes had ended up on my front step. You know, I don't know. You know, thankfully there's a food pantry that's very close that does take them. But my husband laughs, you know, he'll come home and around Thanksgiving it happened, and it just happened maybe 2 weeks ago. You know, and he's like, oh, he goes, I guess you hit the wrong button again. Same thing with the prime rib. I had no intention of making prime rib. I actually wanted to order a roast beef. And I got my bill and my husband said, he said, oh, he says, did you order, you know, a lot? I said, no, I said, just a little. And the bill was like $120. Well, yeah, when you ordered a $60 piece of meat, right?
Right.
I mean, I was like, well, I better not burn this. That's the first thing that I thought of. But yeah, I mean, you know, like you figure things out. And it's also a creative outlet. You know, cooking can be creative, just like the crafting with the kids. I mean, you can put in different herbs, different tastes. You know, I just recently discovered kosher salt. I didn't even know, you know, like it was just like a little bit harder of a salt. It's a little bit more grainy. Definitely makes a big difference in the cooking. But I had always been using just, you know, plain old iodized salt. And, you know, this has really made a big difference. And my husband has noticed it and we like it. But, you know, get creative in the kitchen, you know, try it. I'm going to start barbecuing this summer. I've never done that before. And I'm getting a barbecue and I want to try to barbecue.
I've talked to a few blind people who do barbecue. I haven't done it as much since losing my vision, but I have talked to some blind people who do it. So it's interesting to see how that goes, but I know it can be done. So if anybody's going to do it, I know you will.
But you have to check back with me. We're going
to
see. I mean, I'm not going
to
do like a whole pig or anything like that, but I mean, no. I think I can handle a hot dog or a hamburger.
But I think ultimately a lot of what this comes down to, what you're talking about, further proves the mantra that I've had for many, many years when it comes to blindness and how to do or handle certain things. It's a two-step mantra: patience and a sense of humor. And if you've got patience and somewhat of a sense of humor, you're going to get through a lot of these things, whether it's changing the diapers, whether it's doing the arts and crafts with the child, whether it's going into the kitchen and just trying. That's the other one, is just trying it out and seeing what you can do. And once you've tried, you have the patience to do it and a little bit of sense of humor to go with it. Blind or not, you're going to find that you can accomplish a lot of great things, not only just around the house, but in many different things. So I really like a lot of the things that you said here about, you know, how you've gone through this and handled these different obstacles, we'll call them for lack of a better word, and really being able to turn them into something else and take charge of them.
It's, you know, and it's so funny, Tim, that you say that, because you have got to laugh, because if you don't laugh with these kids, they'll kill you. Yeah, you have to laugh on a regular basis, and have a good sense of humor, and you absolutely can, you know, get through anything.
Absolutely. Well, on that very happy note, I'd like to thank you so much, Holly, for joining me on this episode of the Life After Blindness podcast. I really appreciate you coming on. If anybody wants to get more information about yourself or get in contact with you, tell us how we can do that.
So you could reach me at blindmotherhood.com. So it's www.blindmotherhood.com. You could email me at holly@blindmotherhood.com. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I also have a YouTube channel, all called Blind Motherhood.
Very good. Everybody be sure to check Holly out on all those different formats. And again, thank you, Holly, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Tim. I had a great time.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, at the end of April 2017, it marked the 2-year anniversary of the Apple Watch. So I thought I would take a moment to talk about not only my experiences with my Apple Watch, but to describe the differences between the current generation watches, Series 1 and Series 2, so that anybody out there that hasn't bought one yet or is still struggling on making that decision to buy one, hopefully this can give you some additional information when shopping for your Apple Watch. So first of all, let's talk about the history of the Apple Watch. 2 years ago, they released what is now being called Generation 1, or as some tech bloggers call Series 0. And that one has now been discontinued. You can still get it on eBay or online and other places, but for the most part, it has been discontinued. The current generation, Generation 2, there are two primary models, Series 1 and Series 2. And so first, I want to talk with you a little bit about the major differences between those two watches. So a lot of the difference between the two comes down to GPS. Series 2 of the new generation watches has built-in GPS, so you don't have to have your iPhone nearby. So if you're someone who does a lot of walking, does marathons, either walking or running marathons, just a lot of outside exercise or outside work, whether you go hiking or, like I said, walking, marathons, things of that nature, and you don't take your iPhone with you, Series 2 might be something that you'd want to look at because of the built-in GPS. But keep in mind, even though Series 1 does not have built-in GPS, as long as you have your iPhone nearby or in your pocket, then it will just use the GPS built into your phone as the watch GPS. So if you're a person like me who always has your phone on you, even if you do a marathon or out hiking or outdoors for whatever reason, and you're wanting to track that movement by GPS, well, if you've got your phone on you already, you probably don't need built-in GPS. So that's a major difference to consider is, do I need built-in GPS or not? Do I always have my phone usually with me or not? And that could right there make a major decision for you as to which watch to decide to purchase. The next major difference between the watches is the water resistancy or water capabilities. With the Series 1 watch, you can go into depths of water up to about 3 feet and do that for maybe about 20 or 30 minutes. So you should have no problem going into the shallow end of a swimming pool, taking a shower, even going into the ocean, as long as you limit the amount of time that your wrist goes below water and make sure that it doesn't go below that 3 feet depth. Now, when it comes to Series 2 Apple Watch, you can go into depths much deeper, up to 50 meters in depth for 30 to 50 minutes, or up to 50 minutes, and do diving and more underwater swimming, of course. So again, if you're looking at the difference in Series 1 to Series 2, consider not just your exercise ability, but your swimming ability. So are you a person who just waits at the top of the water, maybe does a little doggy paddle, you don't really do a lot of underwater swimming, you may want to go with Series 1. If you're wanting something, however, that's going to enable you to swim underwater for a lot longer periods of time and handle more depth, then you may want to go to Series 2. Again, either one of them will allow you to wear it in the shower and in shallow depths of water. The major difference here that I would just mention is that with the Series 2, it does have the ability to flush the water out of the speaker. That's where the water is trapped on the Series 2, and they have built in an ability to flush that water out with sonar technology. And that gets the water out of Series 2's watch a lot better and a lot faster than waiting for it to dry on the Series 1. And so what you may find is with both watches, if there's a little bit of water still left in that speaker canal, VoiceOver may be just a little bit garbled until it completely dries. So your experiences may vary, but I've seen with Series 1 that once you've gotten that speaker area wet, it does take quite a while for that area to dry and for VoiceOver to not be as garbled. But it's not a game breaker, in my opinion. That being said, with the Series 2, you do flush more of that water out, and so perhaps VoiceOver will be less garbled quicker than it would be with the Series 1. The final major difference that you will want to consider when purchasing an Apple Watch and looking between Series 1 and Series 2 is the display. In Series 2, the type of display that is used is extraordinarily bright compared to Series 1. Not that Series 1 isn't bright, it's very good, it's a Retina display, and it looks fantastic from what I'm told on the watch, but Series 2 is much brighter and looks a lot better, especially in low light or in the dark. So if you are somebody with some vision or low vision and are going to want to look at your watch, maybe having the extra brightness of the Series 2 is going to appeal to you, especially, like I said, when it's nighttime or when you're in darker areas. If that doesn't appeal to you as a low vision person, or you have no vision at all, and obviously it's not even a consideration at all, then again, it's another reason to go back and look at Series 1. So when considering these three major differences to make my own Apple Watch purchase, I ultimately decided to go with Series 1. I don't do any underwater swimming at all. If I go into a pool, I'm usually playing with my daughter or my family and just walking around in the shallow end and playing in the water. And so I didn't need anything that would allow me to go and swim any deeper than that. As far as the built-in GPS of the Series 2, again, it wasn't necessary for me because even though I do walk or run marathons and do go outside where I want GPS to track where I am or where I've been, I always, in my case, have my iPhone on me. So for me, it's not a big deal for the Apple Watch to just use the GPS in my phone because it's always there. So again, the GPS built-in wasn't something that was a necessity for me. As far as the brightness of the Series 2, again, I have very, very little vision at this point. I can see some light and some movement if it's very close to my face. And so the extra brightness of Series 2 wasn't something that was going to help me at all either. And so based on that, like I said, I ultimately decided to go with Series 1. As far as using the Apple Watch goes, that, of course, will vary from person to person. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the most common things that I use my Apple Watch for. So first and foremost, the Apple Watch is a watch. So of course you can tap the screen to get the time. And for blind and visually impaired users, there is a tactile feedback function where you can tap the screen twice when it's asleep and it will vibrate on your arm to tell you the time. These different types of tapping on your wrist sound kind of difficult, but if you go in and look at the different options and how you can have it tap the time on your wrist, they actually do make sense. And after using it a couple times, you'll find that you'll want to use that quite a bit in places where you don't want to have an audible readout of the time and just have it secretly or privately telling you what time it is. As far as other ways of using time, the watch, of course, can do timers and alarms really, really well. So you can either go into the alarms app or the timers app and set those manually, or say, "Hey Siri, 10-second timer," or "Hey Siri, set an alarm for 2 o'clock," or "Hey Siri, set an alarm for 30 minutes. And it will automatically do that for you. So I find that I use that quite a bit, setting timers, setting alarms, and doing that with dictation with Siri as opposed to having to go in and do it manually. Obviously, what the watch does best is help you with health and fitness. Built right into the app, it has the ability to track your activity and all of your fitness workouts, whether you're walking, running, doing the elliptical, or other types of workouts. You can have your watch track all of this, tracking your calories and the time spent, and sync that to the health app on your phone so that you can keep track of all of that data. You can also track your steps throughout the day, as well as the ability to be reminded to stand at least once per hour, as well as breathe throughout the day. Those I've actually found to be very helpful. I know that a lot of people in the beginning made fun of the idea of being reminded to stand once an hour, but it really does come in handy, especially if you're a person who sits a lot, has a desk job or something where you have to sit down a lot. To be reminded to stand at least that once per hour is quite helpful and does help your legs and your circulation. And so I found that very useful. When they introduced iOS or watchOS 3, I should say, they added breathing. And what that does is for a set period of time within a certain periods of time throughout the day, it will walk you through just taking deep breaths. And I've actually found that that's been very helpful as well. So that I'm just taking that moment, whether it's a minute or a couple minutes, and just focusing on my breathing. And when you do that, it also tracks your heart rate so that you can see before you were starting the breathing technique and after, if that really helps you. And more often than not, I showed that it does. And again, that's another thing that is very helpful is that at any time you can go in and have it tell you what your current heart rate is. So if you feel for some reason that your heart rate is high, then you can, you know, do some breathing techniques or focus on trying to get that down. Another big part of what I do with my Apple Watch is receive notifications. Now, of course, you can tailor make your Apple Watch to do as little or as many or even no notifications as you see fit. But for me, I like to get email and text message notifications, even with Messenger from Facebook, as well as sports notifications, weather notifications, things like that. So I know what the score is for my favorite baseball team. I make sure that I'm receiving texts from my wife or very important emails. And so receiving notifications on the watch is very, very nice, whether you're just checking a quick score or checking the weather alert just to see what's going on, or even just receiving a text from a friend that is come through, you can get that information quickly and quietly and go back to whatever you were doing. And when it comes to receiving text messages, for example, you can then just dictate on your watch a quick response back to that person. There are also pre-made responses. So if you want to select one of those, you can do that as well. Or of course, you can select emojis to send back. So it is really handy when it comes to notifications. And when it comes to communicating with your Apple Watch, something that I know my grandfather would have absolutely loved if he were still alive today is the ability to use your Apple Watch as a phone. You can go full on Dick Tracy with talking to someone on your Apple Watch over the phone and be able to communicate that way without pulling your phone out of your pocket. So you can dial and receive phone calls, use the speaker and the microphone built into the watch, and use it just like Dick Tracy would have. You can also use your Apple Watch as a remote control. So if you're listening to music or the podcasts app or even other third-party apps that have this enabled, you can go onto your watch and play or pause music, fast forward, set things up to be next on a list, all depending on what that particular app allows you to do. And so you can control it right from your watch. So if you have your phone across the room or not available, or you just don't want to unlock your phone for whatever reason, you can use your watch to control that music. Now let's talk a little bit about third-party apps. There are several apps out there that give you much more functionality in your Apple Watch, so many that I can't really go into all of them here, but I will talk to you about some of my favorites. So there are some apps when it comes to exercising, apps like MyFitnessPal, where you can track your calories and food intake for the day. You can access some basic information with MyFitnessPal right on your watch. There is an app called Just Press Record. What that app does is from your Apple Watch, you open the app and it offers just one big record button. You tap that button, or double tap in our case, that button. And right from your Apple Watch's microphone, you can record and save a message that will back up to your iPhone. And you can then play it back later, either on your iPhone or in the cloud. And the recordings with Just Press Record are absolutely fantastic. They're very nice quality and sound really, really good when played back on your phone. And it's a very useful app when it comes to just either having a quick memo or an idea that you want to take down, or if you just want to record something a little bit more long form that you'd like to save for later, even if it's a short segment of a podcast or something else that you want to send to somebody with your voice. Just Press Record is very helpful for that. There are also many fitness apps out there. In addition to, like I said, MyFitnessPal before, there are apps for 7-minute workouts. There are apps that will help you with interval time training. So, for instance, if you want to walk for a minute and run for 2 minutes, or whatever timer you want to set it to be, there are interval apps out there where you can set exactly what intervals you want. It'll tap your wrist to let you know that the time has changed, even offer a little ding or a buzzer to let you know that the time has changed. And so that's something that's very helpful as well. With the increased battery life of the second generation watches, there are people who find that they do have plenty of battery in order to sleep with their watch. Some people don't. Depending on your exercise level and the usage of your watch, you may have to charge it before going to sleep to get this accessibility. But there are apps out there like Sleep Plus Plus that allow you to wear your watch overnight and be able to track your sleep. And so those types of apps are very helpful as well when it comes to tracking your health and fitness and well-being and being able to track your sleep. All in all, I'm very happy with my Apple Watch. I don't think that Apple Watch is yet the end-all be-all device for everything that we need it to do. But I think that it's a really great start, and I'm interested to see what Apple may do with it going forward as technology gets faster and smaller and better and more apps are developed for it. I'm really interested to see what it can become in the future. And like I said in the beginning, it's not going to be for everybody. Everybody may have a different use case for it, and it's up to you to decide whether that use case is worth the price point. But again, I do think that there is something in it for everyone. It just comes down to how you particularly would use the watch. This wraps up episode number 8 of the Life After Blindness podcast. I really hope that you enjoyed my interview with Holly Bonner from blindmotherhood.com, and I hope that you found my discussion about the Apple Watch helpful and informative. As always, you can get the show notes to this episode by going to lifeafterblindness.com/8. While you're there, you can contact me by liking me on Facebook or following me on Twitter. The Twitter handle is @labcast. Or if you'd rather, you can send an email to me. Send those emails to tim@lifeafterblindness.com. I look forward to you coming back and joining me again as we continue to find together that there truly can be a life after blindness. Take care, everyone.